Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, tablet, and online at lsj.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
It's Current State for Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org with your feedback and your ideas. We are always eager to hear from you. Yesterday, General Motors announced its intent to expand operations at Lansing's Grand River Assembly Plant. The $38 million project could bring up to 150 jobs for the region. GM is asking the city of Lansing for a tax incentive that, if approved, could start the project as early as July. And here to talk about this is Current State's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Real good.
Well, thanks. This, of course, is very welcome news for Lansing. The city has had a very long partnership for many years with GM. It's important, though, to point out that this is a proposal, and this is far from being a done deal. And I spoke with Lansing Mayor Virge Brunero about this yesterday. He says the city simply cannot take its relationship with GM for granted.
We have to compete for these jobs. I mean, that's the reality. We have to compete. And so I'm delighted that we're in the hunt. And I think that we're favored because of our workforce, because of the investment that GM has made here. But we can't rest on our laurels. This is a global company. You know, this Camaro is coming in from Canada. GM makes cars all over the world. So it is not a foregone conclusion. This investment or any other investment by General Motors is something that we have to earn.
So, Kevin, the mayor referred to the Camaro production that's going to be happening at LGR. Is this expansion being done related to that?
Well, the mayor really did not want to make that statement on GM's behalf. But it's noteworthy that since the announcement of the Camaro back in December, Norplas Industries has announced its plans to build a 350,000-square-foot facility in Delta Township. Norplas, or Magna as the subsidiary, is a paint line and injection molding company that supports the auto industry. That's expected to create about 400 jobs, and that's certain to have some tie-in to GM's plans for Lansing Grand River Assembly in some way in the future.
And what type of economic package is General Motors looking for in order to do the expansion?
It's looking for a tax abatement that would exempt it from paying personal property taxes, mainly on its equipment. Under Michigan law, companies that apply can be exempted for between 1 and 12 years, depending upon what that particular local unit of government wishes, in this case, the city of Lansing. The expectation is that this deal would reap about $1.7 million over 12 years for the city of Lansing in terms of new tax revenue. And Mayor Brunero has said that even though there's an incentive involved here, the city is going to gain much more than it's going to give.
And what happens now?
Now the request for the tax incentive goes before the city council on Monday night. If it's approved, as you mentioned earlier in your lead, that the construction could begin this July and be finished sometime in 2015. That is roughly the time when people are hearing the rumblings of the Camaro arriving here. There's no real definite date yet. Mayor Brunero says he does not really expect a lot of resistance or trouble with the request. Keep in mind that the Cadillac ATS just won North American Car of the Year. This is the home of the Cadillac ATS, so it's certainly in the city's best interest to keep GM or help GM stay competitive by staying and expanding here in mid-Michigan.
Great, Kevin. Thank you.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks.
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. In Lansing, city leaders and many others have begun digging into pages of new recommendations for addressing long-term revenue shortfalls. Former Mayor Dave Hollister led the 14-person effort beginning about 6 months ago. Mayor Virge Brunero says Lansing needs to come to grips with chronic budget gaps to avoid the possibility of an emergency manager in the future. The Blue Ribbon Financial Health Team divided its work into two areas, long-term costs and debt, and a regional approach to cutting, streamlining, and the like. And joining us to discuss current state, happy to welcome the two key members of the Financial Health Team, Chair and former Mayor David Hollister. Dave, good to see you.
Good morning, Mark.
And MSU Professor Eric Scorsone, who studies municipal finance and is the author of the team's final recommendations. Eric, good to see you.
Good morning.
We should make clear that yesterday's was a draft report, and Eric, you are still writing the final report, but that most of what we learned yesterday is likely to be in the final report?
That's right, yep.
Okay, and that will be formally submitted on Monday?
Monday, right.
Any early response from Mayor Bernero or anyone on the City Council, Dave Hollister?
We've met with the council three times and briefed them throughout the process, so I don't think they'll be surprised. I would be surprised if they embraced it in totality because it's such a significant change, and change is difficult under any circumstances, but being an election year makes it much more complex. But the mayor has encouraged us all along. And I think we'll get a good reception at City Hall.
In an interview this morning, City Councilperson Jody Washington suggested there isn't that much that's new in the proposal. Does the report contain the kind of visionary recommendations that you aimed to come up with, Dave?
We recommend a new facility for City Hall, selling the current City Hall, and jointly financing and administering a administration building with the city of the school district. So there'd be a joint school district community administration building that could be shared with others.
That hasn't come up before, though?
No, not to my knowledge. We suggested $1 million in additional technology and streamlining operations, privatizing a number of things. So I think there are recommendations here that might have been kicked around, but we have a well-documented study now. The work that Eric did creating the understanding of the structural nature of the deficit. I mean, it's appropriate that we hear from GM this morning they're investing here because on the surface it looks like Lansing's doing very well. Lansing is a well-managed city. Lansing has significant investment going into it. But underlying this facade of prosperity and vitality is a cancer that's eating away at Lansing and other communities. And that's this unfunded legacy cost and unfunded healthcare liability that Eric has documented in a separate study. So you got two studies here we're talking about,
right,
all coming at the same time that Detroit has an EM, an emergency manager. So these things really point to a major structural problem in our financing of local government. So you've got operational issues and finance issues both.
Eric Scorsone, you look at this issue statewide and out of state, possibly. I mean, does the final report, do you consider it visionary? Do you consider these visionary recommendations?
I do, because I think we're looking at really rethinking city government. And so there may be some specific proposals that have been around for a while, but not in this comprehensive way. And we're really saying we need a Lansing 2.0, a government 2.0. And so the investments are there. The reductions in the budget are there. We're recommending reductions for next budget year. We're also recommending investments, and I think it is different. I think we're looking at, working with the school district to form potentially a cooperative venture that would be very different than what's happened in Michigan. And I think we have to keep in mind, as Dave said, I mean, it's great to see economic expansion, but we have to keep in mind the city's unfunded liabilities are, millions of dollars. So, $1.7 million in revenue over 10 or 12 years doesn't translate into, maybe $100,000 a year. But we're talking about unfunded liabilities in the range of $15 to $20 million a year.
That's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, is it not, for virtually all municipalities in Michigan?
It is. It is from Detroit to Bay City to Lansing to Flint to all kinds of places.
And there were two parts to your recommendations: long-term solutions, which focused on those legacy costs, as I understand it, And this is where the lion's share of Lansing's red ink is. You propose ending retiree health care plans, at least for new employees, and moving toward a defined contribution approach as opposed to a defined benefit approach. Briefly, could you explain how that works?
Well, a defined contribution plan would be similar to what people have, like a 401k. So the city would put in some money, the employees would put in some money, and then, you know, the employee has to manage those investments for their retirement. Whereas with a pension system, the city's providing funding and providing a benefit in the future. And so we're saying we think the city needs to adjust and move forward with some different plans for new employees. And even for existing employees, there's probably going to have to be adjustments, particularly to health care.
Mark, a particular concern and controversy will be the police and fire. Right now, the Teamster members at City Hall and the UAW members and others have contributed. They've had furlough days. They've contributed more to their health care. There's a number of sacrifices that they've made. But because the fire and police unions are protected by 312, binding arbitration, they have been unwilling to negotiate those same kind of concessions. We recommend here taking those funds out and assuming they're going to make those recommendations and have equity of sacrifice. I mean, the city employees clearly have sacrificed. And if they choose not to do that, there would be a reduction in force. That's never been that explicit before. We are very concerned, if you're going to go forward in this region, that the cost, that per capita cost, for our police and fire be brought more in line with benchmark communities in Michigan and in the region. And that's something that the council and the mayor have not dealt with in the past.
But how is the sacrifice, how will that sacrifice become more equitable in the future? Are you saying the unions need to give up more? They need to concede more?
The police and fire need to concede something. At this point, they've conceded nothing.
Okay, but you say they have made concessions in the past. They need to continue to make concessions.
The regular employees, the general employees, the police and fire employees have not contributed the concessions in their health care.
Okay. As a former mayor, you've got insights into what it's like to deal with city unions. How willing do you think they will need to be? This is a big, important discussion that needs to take place then.
The viability of the city is at risk. I think Eric's documented that. We're talking 5 to 7 years. The city could be facing an emergency manager like Detroit and Flint have. So the degree that people push back or run from or deny these recommendations, the day of reckoning simply comes sooner. These are arrows that are long established, the loss of property tax values, the loss of state revenue, personal income, population have been going down for decades. We've documented that in this report. And the legacy costs are going up in the opposite direction. Those arrows are going up at a 45-degree angle and continue into perpetuity, and you simply cannot continue to finance local government that way without insolvency at some point. I'm saying 5 to 7 years. If the folks at this city are unable to wrestle and solve this, it'll be 3 to 5.
Eric Scorsone, does the implementation of the Affordable Care Act from the federal government make some changes possible here in terms of health care savings for the city?
Well, potentially, but I mean, it may actually raise the cost of health care because there'll be more administrative burdens. The positive side of it may be that with these new state health exchanges, there may be an ability to move some of the retirees, either current or new future retirees, into the exchanges. That's what the city of Chicago is looking at. And the city might provide a subsidy to purchase insurance on the exchange.
You recommend that in your report?
Well, we're recommending it needs to be examined because we don't know what Michigan's exchange is going to look like yet. And Illinois has already been set up, essentially, so we don't know what our system will be.
The team recommends consideration of privatization of some city functions, parking, waste hauling, and other functions. Generally, did you get an idea of how much more privatization the city could do? Is there still a lot of room to privatize services?
We're looking at cemeteries. We're looking at golf. Well, we think solid waste is one. Or waste pickup is ripe for development. There are some other new ideas we talk in about forming a metro authority and beginning immediately to work on joint purchasing with the school district, a joint information technology officer. We're talking about doing some regional stuff immediately. So there are savings there as well.
Let's move to that regionalism piece. Your recommendations appear to focus on consolidation and streamlining of city administrative services with the Lansing School District. And here your group identified the sharing of an administration building, one building that would contain both of these public institutions. What makes that a good recommendation? Eric?
Well, I think both institutions have fewer employees today, and I think with City Hall and the status it's in, we can find a better way to put these together. Just like, say, Detroit and Wayne County share a building, for example, and you can share purchasing, IT. We're recommending a chief information officer that would be shared between both entities, for example. And I think there's a lot of efficiencies that can be garnered. And the two entities could actually create a kind of a regional authority. And that authority could even bring in other members later on.
Right. We're looking at assessing functions that could be done in the region for other municipalities. We're talking about back office operations, accounting functions. I mean, there's numerous services you can share. And we recommend that you get started on that immediately. One of our members was Steve Liddle, and he's a young legal eagle, worked for the governor Governor Granholm, and he was pointing out all these new tools that have been made available to local governments, and we need to really embrace them enthusiastically and aggressively. And I think Lansing with this blueprint can become a model. I think this 2.0 idea is really important, that this is really redefining how we do business. And there aren't many at City Hall been talking about a joint administrative building with school officials or joint purchasing or joint anything. They have a hard time talking to each other on certain days. So we think we're breaking the mold here, and we've got a bold plan, and it's up to them to embrace it and run with it.
The comparisons with the Simpson-Bowles plan on the national level are unavoidable here. Dave, are members of the team, including yourself, going to take an active role, a la Simpson and Bowles, in keeping this report in front of city leaders and the public in the future?
I think so, and I think the local media will as well. The State Journal gave it great coverage. One of our local TV stations has set aside a major commitment to focus on this. It's up to the business and community leaders now to hold the council and the mayor's feet to the fire. This is not going to be easy. The easy ones are done many years ago.
Yeah.
These are hard, and I commend the city and the mayor for having the courage to do it in an election year.
Former Mayor David Hollister is the chairman of Lansing's financial health team, and MSU Professor Eric Scorsone is writing the team's final recommendations for formal presentation on Monday. Dave, Eric, many thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A bill is moving through the state legislature that would expand the state's oversight of struggling Michigan schools. On Wednesday, the Republican Majority House Education Committee approved House Bill 4369 and sent it to the full House. That was after our next guest spoke vigorously against the bill. Lansing School Superintendent Yvonne Canal-Kamul says the move to enhance the impact of Michigan's Education Achievement Authority is, quote, not about education, it's about politics. Yvonne Canal-Kamul, welcome back to Current State.
Yeah, hi, Mark. Good morning. How are you?
Really, really good. Could you remind our listeners what the EAA is briefly, please?
The EAA is a parallel school system run by the governor and his appointees that take schools that are identified as underperforming for a period of 4 years, takes them under their umbrella and provides them with an alternative reform model and sort of takes them over, as it were. They currently have 15 schools, I think about 15 schools in the Detroit area, and they just began this initiative this fall.
And this would basically move the 15 schools in the Detroit area, and it would increase them to the bottom 5% of all of the schools in the state, correct?
It does identify the bottom 5%. The way the bill is fashioned right now, I believe, is that it would increase that number by 35 schools to now have 50 schools in the EAA.
And why do you oppose this expansion? This impacts Lansing schools, potentially. I think that's part of this.
Well, sure. I mean, it does affect one of our schools sooner rather than later. But really, as an educator, I'm very concerned about the fact that we are now launching into a reform model that has absolutely no track record whatsoever. We have no idea whether or not this is going to be a successful reform. There are no data that or no research that would indicate that this would be a successful reform. And so I just believe that it's unfortunate that we're willing to throw our schools into an experiment that really has no data to support any potential success.
Supporters like Republican State Rep. Lisa Postumus-Lyons, who sits on the House Ed Committee, point to increased student attendance and parental involvement in the Detroit schools, where the EAA has launched. The governor made a big deal out of this in his State of the State address and found participants who were pleased enough to appear on behalf of it at the Capitol last night. What do you make of their arguments for the success of EAA in Detroit?
Well, I think all of us can produce anecdotal evidence of success. I can certainly, bring together parents who are happy with our school district and our high school that seems to be under that watch. I can produce data that would indicate that there's high levels of attendance. I have an elementary school in Lansing that actually scored higher than the state on the state assessment. So, I mean, we can all produce anecdotal evidence. I think what we're asking for is some real hard statistical data that has yet to be brought forth.
For the record, which high school are we talking about?
Eastern High School. It's one of our three high schools in Lansing with a very rich tradition that has graduated illustrious Olympic champions and lawyers and doctors and colonels in the Air Force. I mean, we have a long history of really, really wonderful graduates from Eastern High School, and it's hit some hard times recently, and we're working diligently to turn that tide around.
You're negotiating right now with the Lansing Teachers Union, the LSEA, to, as I understand it, to extend their current contract into the future. I know you can't share much on the substance of those negotiations, but can you tell us when you're likely to be able to share something?
Actually, we met with the board last night in a closed session, and we'll probably be ready for some sort of final decision from both the LSEA and the board by next Thursday at the latest. And I just do want to say, I can't, of course, give you any details, but I want to tell you that the level of appreciation and cooperation that we have gotten from our administration has gotten from the teachers group is just really incredibly admirable. And if I could do anything more than what a budget-strapped district could do, I certainly would.
Yvonne Canal-Kamul is the superintendent of the Lansing School District. Yvonne, thanks for joining us. Stay in touch.
Thanks so much, Mark. Always a pleasure. Bye.
Coming up on Current State, Israeli screenwriter Guy Meursen talks about his film Rock the Casbah. It looks at all of the drama and irony involved in the First Intifada. He is in East Lansing, and he joins us here in our Current State studios. Also, MSU cello professor and performer Seren Bagratuni joins us. Live music in the Current State studios coming up. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan State's Jewish Studies program is holding its 8th annual Israeli Film Festival this weekend. Among the showings is an informal screening of the new film Rock the Casbah, which was a 2012 finalist for an Israeli Academy Award for Best Feature. The film also received an award at the prestigious Berlin Film Festival last month. Rock the Casbah takes place during the First Intifada in the late 1980s. It's the first feature film produced in Israel to address the tumultuous period. The film screenwriter, Guy Mearson, served in the Israeli Army at the time. He's a guest MSU lecturer in screenwriting this semester and joins me now in the Current State Studios. Welcome, Guy.
Hi, Mark.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit, remind our listeners what the First Intifada was, when it took place, and its importance.
All right. So it's one of the chapters of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that took place. It started at December 87, and it was a Palestinian uprising that took place in the West Bank and in Gaza. And during that time, it was a lot of demonstrations and stone throwing, and the army was brought into the cities, into Gaza, and into the West Bank, in order to quiet things up.
Okay, and intifada is loosely translated as uprising.
Uprising
or
in Arabic. Yeah.
Okay, and give us a synopsis of what your film addresses.
So the film starts with an event of the soldiers in Gaza. Stepping in, just walking in the alleys of one of the refugee camps, and they are being the stones being thrown into them, and they start chasing the kids, the people that throw stones at them, and then one of the soldiers is being hit by a washing machine that is being thrown at him from one of the rooftops, and then. Afterwards, this group of soldiers are being put on that rooftop in order to find who threw the washing machine. And they just stay there for, you know, several days and weeks. And they have this kind of a relationship going on with a family that they stay on the top of their house. And of course, the relationship between themselves.
So this is fiction. This is not a documentary thing.
Right.
These things didn't really happen. But I understand this is the first Israeli film, fictional film, to address the First Intifada. Is that time period a difficult one for Israelis? And if so, why?
I think so. Well, you know, all the chapters, the different episodes of the conflicts have their own significance, but this one is really a very special one. I think it's the point in time in which the Israeli army start doing policing work and not, you know, army work. They it's the least glorified war, I would say. So in the last several years, we had several Israeli films dealing with the first Lebanon War took place back in 82.
Yes.
Now the Lebanon War, and we had films like Lebanon and Bufor and Waltz with Bashir, all films that had really great success in the US and Europe. Now that was the last, I would say, sort of regular war, the Lebanon War, a war in which, you know, one army was fighting another army. In the First Intifada, it was mainly very tiring war for the soldiers. They had to chase kids, 14-year-old kids. So it was not very. It was not very simple to deal with this kind of conflict.
And you were an Israeli soldier in the First Intifada, correct?
Right. I was a medic in an infantry unit. And, of course, it is based on my personal experience, and on Yariv Horovitz, who is the director of the film personal experience as well. So I spent a lot of time in the Gaza Strip, and Yariv spent a lot of time in the West Bank. And we met later on, maybe 10 years ago, we met, and we really wanted to write a film about this, because we had a lot of experience, a lot of issues that were sort of undealt with, and we thought that people should know about this time in Israel and about this part of history. So we started telling each other what happened to us, and then after we told several stories and we spent a lot of time talking about it, I sat down and I wrote the film.
War's been portrayed as anarchic in movies in the past, but this is a different kind of anarchy,
yeah.
It seems, moving from the military exploits to these policing exploits and these bizarre encounters with Palestinians between the army and such. The film is a lot about that, I gather?
Yes. So what I really wanted to do is to take off heroism off the thing of, war film, because this war was anything but heroic. So what the soldiers are dealing with, just spending time together, is boredom, is, lack of food and hunger, and just teasing each other and needing to go to the bathroom and not being able to do so. So this is the kind of a war film that is really dealing with the uncomfortable state of the soldier.
How's the Israeli movie-going public absorbing your film? How are they responding to it?
All right, so it's always hardest in your state, in your place. So I think for Israeli audience, it's very hard to go and again deal with watching, films about the conflict on their night off. They kind of want to go and see Hollywood films, or they rather do so. But response that we get for dealing with the issue. So we don't have a lot of audience coming in Israel, but we had a lot of audience in Europe and in the film festivals, and I hope that people will come and see the screening here.
The film is showing this weekend as part of the Israeli Film Festival put on by MSU's Jewish Studies program. When and where, please?
So right here in this building, Communication, Art and Science, 147, I think it's the number of the room, Sunday, 7 p.m.
Very good. And we would have probably played a clip from the movie. It is in Hebrew, but there will be subtitles
right
at the presentation on Sunday as well.
Right.
Screenwriter Guy Mearson's latest project is Rock the Casbah. See it Sunday night here at Michigan State. Guy Mearson, nice to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Current State. A new production opening tonight at MSU's Wharton Center pays homage to the Harlem Renaissance. In the 1920s, the arts were a white-dominated industry in America. Most representations of African-American life were done in parody. One of the most popular programs of the day was Amos and Andy. It debuted in 1928 with two white actors who would later appear on screen in blackface. But at the same time, an explosion of African-American literature, dance, and music was coming out of New York's Harlem neighborhood. Tonight, The Garden of Joy opens for a two-night run at the Wharton Center. Current State's Kevin Lavery stepped back in time to Harlem, New York, 1929.
In the 1920s, America was teeming with cars and credit, juke joint jazz, and bathtub booze. The whole country, it seemed, was caught up in the perpetual pursuit of happiness. African Americans left the South in droves in search of jobs up north. They found new homes in many cities, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland. But for blacks with dreams of fame and fortune, no urban mecca shined brighter than New York's uptown enclave, Harlem. Harlem boasted a number of legendary nightclubs like the Cotton Club, the Savoy Ballroom, and the Garden of Joy, depicted on stage this week at the Wharton Center. These hotspots were the nexus through which streamed a torrent of black culture.
So you have a period in the 20s where there's a party that went on in a beautiful, concentrated area.
That's actor Sean Hamilton, who portrays record company tycoon Harry Pace.
African Americans felt free to talk about their experiences in the South and
openly,
what it meant.
Yes, without having that fear of what would happen to them and the consequences.
The lady finishing Hamilton's thought is Charita Best, who brings chanteuse Dorothy Battle to life. A momentous occasion propels the storyline, a live radio broadcast from the dance floor of the Garden of Joy. It's New Year's Eve, 1929. Stocks have crashed, the Depression is looming. It's Harlem's last hurrah. Garden of Joy expresses both the celebrations and commiserations of African-American life. The Harlem Renaissance was the launch pad for many black superstars, Josephine Baker, Billie Holiday, Duke Ellington. But music director Alvin Waddles notes the stigma of segregation was never far away.
They were playing at the Cotton Club to largely white audiences because if you were African-American, you couldn't come to the Cotton Club. So, you know, you had all these opportunities for performance without yet being allowed into society. And we, of course, know that this whole trend would continue even through World War II, where you were allowed to fight for your country but not really live in it.
You can feel the wrongdoing in Best's voice when the lady sings the blues. The Harlem Renaissance was also a study in communal advancement. The 20s possessed a distinctly liberal activism that was rarely seen until the 1960s. Harlem was the birthplace of the Rent Party, a rollicking soiree where neighbors passed the hat. Again, music director Alvin Waddles.
They were striving to help one another just to exist. Even artists who were doing relatively well on a certain social economic plane were not disconnected from the rest of their society.
Singer Charita Best says that's where the fictitious radio show meets the historic Harlem tradition.
And then at the end, what happens is we actually have a rent party, which is different and unique because normally rent parties were held at homes. You know, everyone got together and chipped in and helped each other out. This is a little different. This is unique. So there's never been a like radio rent party. So that's what makes this slightly different from, you know, the normal rent parties that they would have in Harlem.
Up to the Savoy Ballroom. Past the Savoy, full of people doing the Lindy Hop.
Woo! Baby, who let you in here?
While music is central to the Garden of Joy, it's not a musical per se. It also infuses the writings of poets like Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and W.E.B. Du Bois. Actor Sean Hamilton says the production is a snapshot of a shining moment in American history.
It only lasted for a very short period of time. Money flowed and artistry flowed, and once the 30s came and the Depression really hit, that gate came down.
Of course, the Depression was not the end of black cultural vitality. In the end, says Best, the Garden of Joy is a tale of survival.
As a people, that's what we know to do, how to survive during the good times and the bad times. I mean, we make the most out of anything. We can take, you know, nothing and make something out of it.
Ah!
Garden of Joy runs tonight and tomorrow in the Wharton Center's Payson Theater at Michigan State University. For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. This Sunday, the 13th annual Cello Plus Chamber Music Series gets underway at MSU's College of Music. MSU cello professor Suren Bhagratuni organizes the event and performs with his musical colleagues throughout the festival. Professor Bhagratuni joins us in the Current State studio now to play some Bach in a moment and to tell us more about Cello Plus. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This is the 13th annual Cello Plus Chamber Music Festival. How did this get started?
Well, it got started a little bit earlier while I was in Illinois. And then here, our dean asked me to maybe it would be possible to bring it over here. And actually, he financed it because I wasn't financed before. So, and then my friends heard about it and they like to come here and play, just communicate with each other and meet new people and new audience. So it's
beautiful. How many events took place in Illinois and how many have taken place here at Michigan State?
In Illinois, I could do only about three concerts. Here, I do three or four. And now we started doing Bach Around the Clock, which is a marathon, whole day Bach music on his birthday on March 21st. So it's quite an event.
So that's coming up as well. Bach Around the Clock?
Yes, that's the name. I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit...
When and where does that take place?
It took place, the first time it was last year, and because it was very successful, we decided to do it this year, and then it got a very generous sponsorship from Bill and Joan Church, so they are our sponsors for that event.
Okay.
Yes.
Cello Plus takes place over several days with many performers.
Yep.
Take us through the venues, the music, and the musicians involved.
Okay, the venue is only one. It's a Cook Auditorium. It's a newly renovated auditorium at Music Building. And then we have first concert dedicated to Schubert, although it's going to be different music performed. Also, I have a singer from New York who's going to sing some Schumann and Grieg songs. Then we are playing Schubert's famous trio, the second E-flat major trio. That's the first concert. Second concert will be dedicated to young or early years of Beethoven. It's his three string trios from Opus 9. It's going to be only one event. Then we start Bach Around the Clock, 12 o'clock concert, 3 o'clock concert, and 7:30 concert. In between, our students are going to perform his... French suites. So it's going to be full day of Bach.
And what time does it get started?
It starts at 12 p.m. at noon.
Okay, 12 noon
yeah.
This Sunday at the Cook Auditorium.
No, I'm sorry. Sunday is the first concert. It's a Schubert and more at 3 p.m.
Okay, very good. You are bringing together not only MSU musicians, but also visiting artists. Are
yes.
These musicians who have performed together often?
Not, maybe sometimes even never. Sometimes they just meet here for first time.
So there's real spontaneity to,
yes,
this,
absolutely,
to this presentation.
Absolutely. Yes, some of us are acquainted with each other. Some of us played with each other. Some of us never heard about each other.
How long have you been playing the cello?
Oh, that would be 46 years. No, 45.
45 years, and you have a beautiful instrument here you're holding on to. Tell us about it.
The instrument is made by one of the sons of Carlo Bergonzi. His name was Michelangelo Bergonzi. It's made in Cremona in 1778.
My goodness. And describe, and you've owned this and played this for how long?
Oh, this one is in my possession for probably 20 years only. I was very lucky. I was touring Switzerland, and I found it in the shop, and I fell in love with it, and I decided to buy it.
And it's never been far from your side ever
never.
Since. Is that right?
It sleeps in my bedroom.
Does it sleep in your bed? That's
no.
What we want to know.
I'm afraid I can crush it. No.
Okay. How many other instruments do you own? I'm
really
curious.
I have a couple of more cellos, but nothing this old or valuable.
Okay. You are going to play some unaccompanied Bach for us, part one of the monumental collections of work for solo cello from J.S. Bach. Yeah. Talk about the importance of these pieces and tell us what they mean to you as a cello player.
They mean to me a lot because I grew up with this music. Since I'm 10 years old, I've been playing these suites. Not all of them, of course, because they are not very simple, but they've been accompanying me pretty much all my life. And those are very significant pieces, I would say most important for the cellist. They occupy the most important spot in any cellist's repertoire, so everybody has to know them. They are incredibly popular, even for non-cellist audiences or non-musicians even, because they are beautiful and they are written 17th century in Kyoto, and it's the only period when Bach was writing instrumental music.
This is the kind of music where even people who don't consider themselves classical music enthusiasts are probably going to recognize some of these things. They're such monumental pieces.
Yes, and you know, very interesting thing about Bach, I found out myself when I heard some arrangements. Jazz musicians take the theme from Bach and mm-hmm. improvise on it, and it still sounds beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing can change the beauty of this music.
One of my most treasured albums is classical guitarist Christopher Parkening.
Oh yes,
and his album Parkening Plays Bach, yeah. And a good number of those are cello pieces that have been transcribed to the guitar. That one's
exactly.
That's the album that sleeps with me.
Yes, okay.
Parkening plays yeah. Bach. Tell us about what you're going to play for us.
I will play probably Sarabande from his C major suite, which is number 3. And then we'll see. If we have more time, I'll go on.
We would enjoy that. Why don't
Thank
you make
you
your way
much.
Over to our microphone? This will be our first live music that we've ever had performed in Current State. And we have talked about this for months and months and months. So we're off to the races. And he is all set here with his Berganzi. Again, this is MSU cello professor Seren Bagratuni performing Bach on Current State. That's cellist Seren Bagratuni of Michigan State University. He's the organizer of this Sunday's Cello Plus Chamber Music Series. It starts at 12 noon at Cook Auditorium at Wharton Center, Michigan State University. Coming up Monday on Current State, we'll discuss the plight of Michigan cities with Michigan Municipal League Dan Gilmartin, and we'll try to explain in the plainest language possible what the heck the Higgs boson is. That and more. Monday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabby Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended. With 16 locations, including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor, flukehearing.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.